Hello and welcome to MedPod, the official CPD podcast for Maiden Early Trust staff by Maiden Early Trust staff. In each episode, we are joined by a member of Trust staff to share their area of expertise, interest or research in the hope that it will inspire our listeners to try out something new in their own practice. I'm Chloe Bateman, a history and religion and philosophy teacher at Maiden Early School, and I will be your host this week. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Laura Ashton, geography teacher at Maiden Early School, to discuss her classroom practice and research into the use of movement and gesture within geography. Laura, I was wondering if you could start just by giving us a little bit of background on your career and your experience so far.
Okay, so it's quite a simple background. Following training as a teacher in 2004, I moved to Maiden Early School and I've stayed here ever since. So that's 17 years in the geography department.
Wow.
It's quite difficult to leave.
So we're really lucky to have you here to kind of draw on all of that experience then to discuss the use of movement and gesture within geography. I just was wondering, why is it this particular topic that you're interested in sharing with us today?
Okay, so when I first started training, VAC learning styles, visual, auditory, kinesthetic was really forefront, and we had to consider the needs of the students under those three categories. And therefore incorporate things like using plasticine or actions in the lessons to fulfil that. But as VAC faded and its validity was questioned, and rightly so, I still felt that the gestures and the movements that we did in our lessons were still valid. And I did feel that it did embed understanding and recall more deeply. And I also felt that students could access the material better, particularly complex ideas, better if we use movement or gesture. And I was also conscious that teachers use gesture all the time. And so I wanted to consider just effective ways to use gesture and movement in lessons in geography.
So in terms of what you're talking about here, is this coming from your own classroom practice or is it research or is it a little bit of both?
So from when I trained to be a teacher, I've tried to incorporate gesture and movement in my lessons. And over time, I refined it by assessing which bits aided learning and which was potentially frothy fun. Mm. And so I omitted those bits from the lessons. And then honestly, when I knew that I was going to come and speak to you, I thought it would probably be a good idea to see if my teaching hunch that gesture and movement was aiding learning, to see if that was backed up by research. And I was really relieved to find that it was. And in fact, by doing the research, it's given me more ideas about how I can incorporate different movement and gesture in my lessons going forward.
That's really interesting. I think it's kind of more realistic sometimes to say that, you know, not everything does start with the research and practice. And actually with action research, it can start with practice. You do the research, but then it actually informs and refines your own practice going forward.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
That's the really interesting about teaching, because you're always doing that in the classroom.
Sure.
On a day-to-day basis. So you mentioned before that all teachers do use gesture and movement to some degree in lessons. So do you think what we're talking about here could actually be applicable across the curriculum then?
I would say yes, but the examples I'm using are from geography, because that's what I know, and what I know can assist understanding. But from the research is generally not subject specific, so therefore could easily be applied to other subjects. I do want to provide a disclaimer, though, that I am aware that other teachers might be using gesture and movement a lot more than me, and also may have done a lot of this research before. But hopefully this is a little summary.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even if people are already doing it, knowing the why of it is actually really important and valid anyway, I think. So when you're talking about gesture and movement, are we literally referring to students kind of moving their hands around, waving their hands, physical movement, that kind of thing?
Yes. I love the fact that you're waving your hand around at the moment. I love how this is an auditory way of learning something, and I'm talking about gesture and movement, and my hands are waving as we go along. But hopefully I'll be able to express my points clearly enough. So yeah, when I'm talking about movement, I'm literally talking about students moving their bodies around the classroom in some shape or form. With respect to gesture, I am aware that there are forms of gesture. So what we've been doing here, Chloe, with just flapping our arms kind of spontaneously, that's what's known as co-speech gesture. There's rhythm gesture. Whenever I think of rhythm gesture, you know, when someone says, oh, that's cool, and they kind of flick their wrists.
Yeah.
That's rhythm gesture. I think we don't perhaps do that so much in lessons, mm-hmm. but then there's iconic gesture, which I think we do a lot of, which is where we use our hands to create pictures right. to help aid understanding. And then there's deictic gestures, which are pretty common if you're doing public speaking or you're a politician and you're doing lots of pointing and chopping motions, etc., mm-hmm. to try and keep the listener engaged. And I think teachers are probably doing all of those yeah. at different times in any given lesson. But yeah, so movement, moving around, gestures, hand actions of some sort.
That's really fascinating actually to hear it broken. I've never actually realised that they all have different names, like all the different types. That's really interesting and useful, I think. So now we've kind of defined the parameters of what we mean by gesture in the classroom and movement in the classroom. I was wondering if you could kind of talk us through some practical examples of how you actually use gesture in geography lessons to aid the cognition of your learners.
Sure. So if we start with movement, the first type of movement I was going to overlook initially, as I wasn't necessarily convinced by it in class, but then by reading the research findings and also talking to Tom, my head of department, I'm now reconsidering my stance on that. So I am talking about the humble information hunt. I'm talking about where the students are in groups, they go round the classroom, either collecting data or information or answering questions, or maybe explaining, having to explain things at each stage. But the idea is that they keep moving around. And if you go into one of my year 10 classes, you'll probably find students who say, "Miss, can you just give us the information? Yeah. Can you pass it around and we'll just stay where we are and that'll be fine." But one thing that Tom, my HOD, said was that it does create episodic learning. So you're moving from one place to another, you're starting a new topic or a new key idea in that new station, and that will help learning. And that was compounded by my reading, because someone called Donnelly and Lamborn in 2011 found that any sort of movement, however limited, even if it's not linked to directly linked to the learning, does actually help with cognition and academic achievement, which kind of made me think about my Apple Watch, which tells me to stand up every now and again. Okay. And I know I looked into the science behind the Apple Watch telling me to stand up. Yeah. I think it's for a few minutes in every hour. And it is meant to be a health benefit, but linked to that, it's meant to be a cognitive benefit as well, to improve focus. So there, and then other research that I looked at shows that it can foster and increase not only concentration, but behaviour.
Right.
So when my year 10s say next time, "Can you pass it round?" I'm thinking, I am going to get them to move around. And also when you think about our students, I know in COVID times it's not so possible, it's not easy to do this. But post-COVID, I think explaining to the year 10s or the year 11s why it's important to move around and how that helps their understanding will help. Other things apart from information hunts would include group jigsawing, or we do speed dating in year 12 yeah. or coastal management techniques and or commercial breaks. But something that physically breaks up the lesson is meant to be good for cognition.
I think that's really interesting, actually, what you said about letting them in on the secret, because I'm sure many of us can, you know, relate to that situation where you've got a class saying, "Oh, why do we have to move around?" And them knowing that background, that research has gone into that activity and the planning of it, I think is really, really key there, definitely.
Sure.
So how else do you use movement then within the lessons?
So sometimes I actually use the whole class to understand a process. And I do this because the student can then experience the process as they move.
Okay.
So Johnson and Glenbury et al. In 2014 say that the more immersive the experience, the better for understanding. Mm-hmm. And of course, we've not got VR headsets for the students, but we can but try. But Sankey and Gardner in 2010 also say that if we can present information in lots of different ways, it does help cognition. So two examples that I would use would be getting the students to understand longshore drift and also wave energy out at sea. So if we start with wave energy out at sea, I feel it's slightly conscious that the scientists may correct me on this. But the idea is that out at sea, the water doesn't move, the wave energy moves through the water, right, which can be quite difficult to understand first time round. So what I get the students to do is to do a Mexican wave. So they do the Mexican wave and they can see that they're doing an up and down movement, but the wave is actually moving across the classroom and they're not running across the classroom with the wave. So if they're a wave particle, not sorry, water particle, they're bobbing up and down, but the wave goes through them. And I find that that's quite an effective way of doing, of explaining that to the class. And then at sixth form, the truth is, out at sea, it does bob up and down, but it actually goes in an orbital, a circular motion. So then we adapt it and we kind of do a Mexican wave, including an orbital shape at sixth form for them to understand what was going on. And then longshore drift, if you know, waves that reach the coast, they come in at an oblique angle and the sediment, the sand gets picked up by the wave. And then the swash, the wave pushes it onto the shore. And then under gravity, the wave pulls back the sediment at not an oblique angle, but at a 90 degree angle. So I get the students to line up and sometimes it's in their rows and they have to do a kind of diagonal step forward and then a vertical step back, so to speak, and a diagonal step forward and then back. And we repeat it until all the class are crushed at one side of the classroom and they've realised that sediment moves along because of the nature of the waves. And whilst we might be able not to be able to see sand physically moving along the coastline, that's the process that's going on. So that's how I try to explain perhaps concepts. The last one would be, I was thinking of, was understanding primary, secondary, rally and love waves, for which are seismic, the types of seismic waves you get from earthquakes. We cover it at A level. And honestly, the best way I've found to do that was for them to wander around the room walking as if they are a seismic wave moving, and also then doing bodily actions.
Yeah.
Obviously, I can't show you on the I'm showing Chloe as I do it, but bodily movements to represent the different types of waves. I hope it helps. So that's where we're up to.
It's obviously creating like memorable kind of learning moments, isn't it, as well?
Hopefully. Yeah.
It's kind of making me think actually of something that I do, and I never thought really too much about why I do it. But whenever I talk about spectrums of, you know, levels of agreement with a statement or like a political spectrum, I always walk up and down the room and I'm gesturing like to the left and to the right with that. And I think it's a similar kind of idea. It's almost like a kinesthetic diagram almost that you're creating, isn't it?
Sure.
With what's happening.
Sure. And I think, sorry, I'm just going, I think in history you also sometimes get students to line up somewhere along a line on a continuum as well. And I think that's really important, that the student makes the decision, but actually the physical movement again is helpful.
Yeah.
But also where they were on that line, they'll probably remember that better than just writing that down in their book.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's another example, yes.
Do you ever find, though, that there are some students who maybe feel too shy or maybe too cool to join in with these exciting activities within your lessons?
Every time. I would say that in year seven, they're just too keen, and so they're all for it. But by the time you do this in year 10 or 11 or at sixth form, yes, you have got too cool for school going on. I think the way to overcome that is, firstly, not to be embarrassed yourself at doing the actions, that you're absolutely convinced at why you're doing that. And if you feel that it's neat, they need to know why I'm asking them to do that. I do, particularly with the older ones, share that this is cognitively going to help them embed their learning. And usually, I would say, you know, with a little bit of cajoling, they all get involved.
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about the why, isn't it, with things like
sure.
this, I think. So it's been really interesting about the movement aspect of it. You've given us such practical examples as well that I'm sure will be useful to geography teachers up and down the land there. If we come on to gesture then, what did you find in the research to support the use of gesture in the classroom?
I actually found that the whole field of gesture and learning has exploded in the last 10 years, and there's plenty of it out there. I think as teachers we take for granted how powerful gesture is. We don't realise the impact it does have on learning without us necessarily realising. So Golden Meadow, who has written quite a few articles on this, in 2011 she said that gesture not only presages learning but can play a role in bringing that learning about. And then she goes on to say that it can change our minds. We can change our minds by moving our hands, which I find incredible that by including hand motions, it can actually change how we think about things.
Yeah.
So I think that's pretty powerful. And then there's Cook in 2010. She showed that students who gesture when learning make memories that last. And then Belloc in 2010 also showed that gesture can serve as a unique bridge between action and abstract thought, which sort of makes sense of why we teach actions to children at nursery with nursery rhymes, that doing actions whilst learning is that much more powerful.
That's really interesting, especially the abstract side of it, because sometimes it is so challenging to think, you know, in history we look at communism, for example, like to think about how you can explain that to a student in a way that's going to be memorable, and to think about how you can use gesture within something like, I think is really fascinating.
Sure.
How do you use gesture in the classroom then?
So I think all teachers gesture all the time. We're continuing to gesture as we record this. but I intentionally use gesture for learning for key terms.
Okay.
So it's widely accepted that the use of gesture is helpful for EAL students, and there's plenty of research into that if you use a gesture with a word. You only have to watch two people who don't speak the same language trying to communicate. All they do is gesture, really. So therefore, using gesture does help understanding. Geography, like lots of subjects in history, have lots of subject-specific terms. And so in order to help them understand the terms, I do it in two ways. Either I get them to copy an action that I'm doing first, like rolling my arms. And then after that, I explain how that links to the key term. So in this case, rolling the arms around equals traction, which is where boulders roll along the bottom of a river. Alternatively, and this one I do prefer, but it does take a little longer, I give the students the definitions first, and then I ask them to come up with the actions.
Okay, right.
So, and when I say actions, in this case, this would include movement as well as gesture. So when we look at something like saltation, which is where boulders bounce along the bottom of a river, then often students think they can just jump up and down and that could represent the thing. And they do, I mean, that's what we use. If I'm getting the students to come up with their own actions, we then usually consolidate that and choose which we think is the best action for the word. And then what we do with that is if there's four or five keywords, they're all linked together. So I've referred to traction and saltation, there's suspension and solution. They are four ways that rivers move sediment or the load. So they're all kind of connected, or we might look at the zones of cities like inner city, CBD, suburb, outer suburbs. Where they're connected, I'd then play something like Simon Says.
Okay.
So the year sevens love it, the year tens love it after a while. But the idea is that I stand up the front, I'll do the action with the word, they copy it, obviously just like Simon Says does. And then I'll stop doing the action, so they have to think about the word and the action. And obviously I'll try and catch them out as well. And then when I do catch them out and I say, you know, saltation without actually Simon Says before, they sit down. Now, I noticed with year 10s that sometimes they just wanted to sit down. So what I try to do is we do practice rounds so that everyone has to do the actions. And the other one I do is they turn into judges, which they love, because then they can look at their fellow geographers and see which ones are getting it wrong, etc., and help me with it. And even that, even just watching, that process consolidates their understanding as well. I think the only problem with that is that they could just be doing word, action, and actually not remember what it was. So throughout that episode of learning, I'll pepper questions in, like, why are you doing the rolling action? Why are you doing this? How does that connect? So ensuring that they are not just remembering the word and the action, they're remembering the understanding behind it. I also think it's powerful for the teacher to keep going back to those hand actions. So when they're using the word again in the following lesson or the following week, they have the actions attached to it. They use the actions from the front. I also find that if a student gets stuck on something, it's sometimes good to try and recall the action. Because they might not remember the word, but they can sometimes remember the action, and that's half the work, and then see if we can elicit the word or the key term from that.
So it's definitely, it can't just be this kind of one-off thing then. It's got to be an embedded part of the practice of you as a teacher.
Yes, and the fortunate thing is with a spiral curriculum, when it comes to rivers or coasts with erosion, we return to it at GCSE and A-level. So if students learn the actions back in year 7 or year 8, they're going to be familiar with them in year 10 and 11 and then year 13, etc.
That's the beauty of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
How else do you use gesture in the classroom then?
So sometimes I use them as a memory hook when students learn about a process in detail, when there's a kind of what happens next and what happens next and what happens next sort of question. An example of this would be plate tectonics. We look at plate boundaries. One example of a plate boundary is a destructive plate boundary, and that's where you get two plates, they collide, one subducts. As they subduct, you get an earthquake. As it subducts further, it melts, and the molten magma, the molten rock, then rises to form a volcano. That's it in its simplicity. And we, fortunately, the hands work perfectly for this. So you get two hands colliding, one subducts. As it subducts, the knuckles kind of meet, causing friction. That friction represents the earthquakes that occur at a destructive plate boundary. As it subducts deeper, it gets hot and it melts and rises and forms a volcanic eruption. And we have actions for that. And what I find is that if there's like a 6-mark question, sometimes if you ask about a destructive boundary, what happens there, students might get it all in the wrong order. But actually having a hand action where it's, right, the plates through convection currents collide first, then it's pulled down, subduction, then you've got the earthquake. The actual hand actions themselves create a framework for them to write sequentially and in the correct order. I think also I like it because I've just mentioned about the spiral curriculum. What we can do is we can use the same hand action and then add extra little details. So where the hand gets subducted, you get an ocean trench. We can talk about where you get the earthquakes. That's known as the Benioff zone, which you'd learn about in year 13. And so in year 13, we'd have a full narrative that goes with this action, which hopefully would be able to help them write a 6 or an 8 mark answer at A level standard.
Yeah.
So it's just a way of hooking information on. And I think I'm not the only geography teacher who's seen students use their hands in exams when trying to write a response. So I think it is effective. And when questioning students, if they get stuck, we can ask them to work through the actions again. And I also get them to think about what it feels like sinking into the mantle. What's the mantle like? Yes, you're going to melt. Well, you'd actually fry as a human, but, you know, as a rock, you'd melt. And there is also evidence that simply imagining as the gesture occurs can actually embed it further. So there's research that says try and imagine it as you do the action and then you'll remember it for longer.
Brilliant. I mean, there's so much kind of detail that you've given us really brought the examples to life there. And I kind of wanted to come back to something that you mentioned at the start, because I know you said you kind of started with doing the gesture movement and then you did the research afterwards to kind of see whether it had that backing.
Yeah.
I just think that's the really interesting thing about being a classroom teacher, isn't it? Because you've got that opportunity every day to put research into practice and see if it works. And I was just thinking, are there any aspects of your own practice now that, because you've done the research, you're going to be incorporating like new aspects into your lessons or changing anything that you do?
Yeah, sure. So I think there's a few things. The first one is to encourage all sorts of gesturing. So if a student is using gesture, spontaneous gesture, co-speech to help with their understanding, to encourage it.
Yeah.
Also for myself to just be more mindful and more intentional in the gestures that I use to help understanding when I'm teaching from the front. I think also, I was thinking about it and thinking about the iconic gestures, and having a young son, I get to watch lots of CBeebies and I look at the presenters there and they use plenty of gesture to keep the young listeners focused and learning. And I think whilst we're not going to be CBeebies presenters, I think it is important to think about the kind of gestures that we use in our teaching. One thing I did find that I don't currently do is that when students are interacting with data like graphs or maps or angles, to actually encourage the students to use actions to show what they're seeing. So if they're seeing a steep curve, to actually use a steep, to kind of use their arms to show a steep curve or a small angle. And someone who's done a lot of research on this is someone called Zhang, and they found out that this works for all ages, including university age groups. So I think when we're looking at maps and distribution, or we're looking at graphs, I'm going to try and get the students to react to the information or the data using their hands, because apparently that helps their cognition. And then finally, I'm not really sure how I'm going to use this, but this did slightly blow my mind, so I thought I'd include it. And it gave me a slight insight as to how someone like Darren Brown might be able to manipulate people's actions. But Zhang and his team found that even if you don't tell people why they're doing an action, it can still help them learn. So they did this thing where they did some research. They got some adults and they told them to swing their arms to improve blood circulation. That wasn't the reason they were to swing their arms, but they did it all the same. Then they found that those who had swung their arms were more likely to solve a puzzle that required a specific insight. So in this case, it was to connect two strings hanging from a ceiling that were too far apart to reach with both hands. And what they had to do is to put a weight on one of the strings to act as a pendulum to swing towards them, and then they could hold both strings. Right. And it was statistically significant that those students, adults, who had swung their arms before the activity performed better than those who hadn't swung the arms. And when they asked the students, why do you think, what was today about, only I think 3 out of 50 had actually consciously noted that the swinging of the arms was helping their cognition. Most of them just thought, oh, it was just blood circulation. So whilst I'm not sure how I'm going to apply that specifically to geography, I think the whole area of gesture and movement is something to look out for going forward, to make the most of the learning that already takes place in the classroom.
Brilliant. I mean, I honestly cannot thank you enough for like the amount of preparation you've done for today, because it's been so insightful and really inspiring actually to have a MetPod episode on something that I think, as you said, people kind of take for granted that mm-hmm. they do, but don't necessarily do it that intentionally at all times. And what the way you talked through your process of doing the research and how that's going to inform your practice is, I just think, really like exemplary for how this should be done. So
we'll see.
Thank you so much. And I mean, we would love to hear from any of our listeners who try and maybe incorporate this into other subject areas, actually, and kind of any insights that you all have. So yeah, do send us in any ideas. But yeah, thank you so much, Laura.
It's a pleasure.
I really hope everyone's enjoyed this as much as we've enjoyed recording it, and we'll see you next month for another episode.